Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and procedures and puts them into everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build public understanding of the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And today, we're going to explore a clash between the judiciary and prosecutors in Washington, D.C., and really a growing breach in attorney decorum towards judges. Before we do that, however, Judge Gail, we've got some updates to bring our audience up to date on from previous shows. And let's start off with the Menendez brothers, Lyle and Eric. We did a program not too long ago about them seeking a new trial. At that time, the then prosecutor in L.A. County was amenable to that. But a new prosecutor, a change of scenery, the motion for new trial has been turned down, and they went up for parole, both of them, and their parole was denied. So from on the cusp of being released, they're back in the slammer for a while.
Indeed they are, and I suspect if anybody was betting on this, hopefully they didn't bet a whole lot. Although I'll tell you, when we covered this story and informed our audience about it, I think there was perhaps some growing belief that perhaps maybe one of two things could happen: either they'd be granted a new trial, or minimally they would be granted parole, given the amount of time that they've served incarcerated. And to see the outcome to be literally goose egg. They are 0-2 on both of those. It's actually, quite frankly, it's a little bit shocking, especially given what we now know about kind of the underpinnings of the case and the additional information that may not have been as well vetted during the first trial. And then secondly, again, with regard to the parole request, the fact that they'd spent so much time behind bars after having been convicted and not having been successful in their request for parole is actually pretty stunning. What do you think?
And neither of them have been disciplinary issues. They both, if we look at prison as a rehabilitative state, they both have been on that course.
Well, I mean, but at this juncture, they're pretty much professors. I think they could probably teach any course that they could possibly offer in prison to rehabilitate anybody. They've been there so long. I mean, I don't know that there could possibly be a course available still for them to take in order to demonstrate rehabilitation.
I agree. Next update, and that is Ghislaine Maxwell. We talked to her about her and Jeffrey Epstein. And when we talked about her, she was filing an appeal, a request for the Supreme Court of the United States to take a look at her case. Well, this week has been the first Monday in October. The court's new session is underway, and one of the first items on the agenda was the court turned down her appeal.
Now,
her attorneys say they're going to fight on and do some habeas corpus and some other things. I'm tossing around the Latin this time.
audience, just by way of review, habeas corpus is essentially Latin. It just says release the body, or you have the body release it. And so they're going to, you know, perhaps create some argument that says
they're trying to get her out is what they're trying to do.
That her physical body's being held unlawfully for whatever reason. They're going to argue that.
She's over in the country club federal prison, 37 acres, I saw today, reading a little bit about this.
Hey, listen, I think I know a couple neighborhood crackheads that would happily go to Club Fed. and do the time there if it means they get what we used to call three hots in a cot, right? So,
yeah,
you know, three hot meals and some place to sleep. She's, you know, she's been transferred from the maximum security institution that she was in to now this very minimum security institution, which, you know, many people colloquially call Club Fed. And as you said, almost almost 40 acres. So with her appeal to the Supreme Court having been denied, I think what you're looking at is someone, quite frankly, who's really gotten kind of like the best outcome you could perhaps even imagine, you know, short of release, but the best outcome you could imagine under the circumstances. And I'm not the least bit surprised at that. But here's where I'm a bit concerned about this, because this woman has been not just charged, not just accused, but she has been tried and convicted of sex and sentenced to 20 years for sex trafficking. So a couple things here. First of all, if there is additional information that has not yet come to light that she's holding back or has held back and now is acting as kind of that additional ace up the sleeve of her attorney, who I believe, by the way, is either longtime friends or has recently befriended Todd Blanche, who's over at DOJ, which, you know, gives me a little bit of heartburn right there because of the nature of what that relationship may be and the perception, even if not the reality, the perception that it doesn't look good is pretty scary to me. The second thing, though, is there should never be anything that a defendant is still holding on to that is that valuable that the prosecution doesn't know about already. That means the prosecution failed in some regard, that there could still be something out there for which they could still hold over the government's head and could utilize for their own benefit later on. That to me is pretty stunning. And that's a stunning failure on the part of the prosecution. And I say that as a former prosecutor. But consider this, Judge Tom. The fact of the matter is this administration has made one of its marquee primary policy issues combating human trafficking. And so it would seem to slap the faces of all of us in American society who kind of rely on the administration to uphold and to embrace and to show fidelity to its own identified priorities, which is combating human trafficking, and then turn around for, you know, whatever reasons to release a convicted human trafficker where the victims
of minors
are minors, and they are still demanding justice from this same administration. So to me, I just think that this water's way too murky. And again, I would not doubt that the president has perhaps taken back to DOJ the requests for a pardon, but ultimately the decision will be his. And I actually celebrate this administration's priority of dealing with human trafficking, whether it's sex or labor trafficking. I celebrate that. And I want to see a very earnest effort to combat and eradicate human trafficking. But I think that it may, you know, rise to the level of rank hypocrisy if you have a convicted trafficker that is incarcerated, and that convicted trafficker then walks out the front doors of Club Fed because they, you know, were able to A, withhold information from the prosecution, not required to release everything, and then ultimately, you know, trades favors with whomever in order to get released. That's an ultimate slap in the face. And so I would hope they would not yield to this. And you're right, I might need to hold my breath, but I'm just going to be loud and proud when I say I think that would be rank hypocrisy.
Well, moving on to item number three for an update, and it fits right into your rank hypocrisy. Sean Diddy Combs,
yes.
Convicted. We talked about his convictions. He was found not guilty of most of the charges, but was found guilty of interstate trafficking in prostitution.
Violating the Mann Act, so yes.
Right. So he came up for sentencing just here a week or so ago, and the prosecution wanted 11 years his attorney, Combs's attorney, said that he wanted just time served. He's been in jail in New York for about a year and a half, if my memory serves me correctly. Yeah, about 14 months. Wanted just time served. The judge said, no, 11 years too much. Time served, we're not going to do that. We're going to give him 4 years in prison for that kind of sex trafficking, and we'll give him credit for the time, the 14 months that he's already served, towards that four-year sentence. Now, all of that sounds be fairly reasonable within reason, but again, in the same news conference where he said he'd talked to the Justice Department about Maxwell's potential pardon, he said that Sean Diddy Combs has been asking the president for a pardon. Those cases similar, different? How do you see those,
so Judge Gay? I think the similarity is it comes down to sex trafficking, for which Mr. Combs was acquitted, but he was convicted of a Mann Act exposure, and so he was convicted of the prostitution charges.
Now that's man, not a gender man.
Correct, M-A-N-N for our listeners. M-A-N-N Act. But that was, again, as it related to prostitution, but he was acquitted on, as you said, all of the other serious charges. So the racketeering, the sex trafficking, any of the charges that could have, quite frankly, landed him in prison for the rest of his natural life. Those he was acquitted on, but you're absolutely right. The two charges that he was actually convicted of for the prostitution carried up to 10 years maximum in incarceration. And so given that, I think on its face, right, if you kind of held up a mirror to these two cases and looked at them, you would say there's clear similarities, at least in the allegations. The fact of the matter is that Ghislaine Maxwell was actually convicted of sex trafficking because of her involvement, her engagement, her compliance, her participation with the now deceased Jeffrey Epstein. And so that's what she was convicted of. And while Mr. Combs was charged with that, he was actually acquitted by a jury of his peers of that specific charge, but not the prostitution part. So that's where the similarity kind of rests. And he's asking for our listeners, he's asking for the pardon on even the prostitution charge that he was convicted of. One thing I do want to note, and I was really appreciative that Judge Subramanian in the New York Combs case was very clear to outline, is the difference between what he called mitigating and aggravating circumstances. So for the benefit of our audience, when a judge is considering, you know, how the punishment should fit the crime, essentially, what is the appropriate balance between what the defendant's been convicted of and how the law through the court should respond with a penalty, a sentence. He was certainly, this hearing took all day. And the defense,
yeah, it went on forever.
I mean, my goodness, I'm wondering if they were teaming for an Oscar, because they went the gamut, including putting together kind of a documentary style video to show the court to demonstrate all of their client, Mr. Combs, his actions and how he's given back, particularly to the Black community. And it really leaned into the fact that as a Black man, he's done so much for his community, which a mitigating factor is a factor, or it's a fact, or it's information that is designed to show the court why a penalty should be lessened. So it is designed to kind of offset what could be perceived as the harshness of a sentence. That's the mitigating, or the lessening of, and it's not, and it should not be used to completely erase or diminish, but it should balance and help to humanize the defendant. As a defense, former defense attorney, I'm sure Judge Hodson, you can appreciate trying to humanize Mr. Combs in a situation like this. And so that's exactly what the defense sought to do with the hours and hours that they had. Everything from character references to letters from supporters to statements in court from family, friends, children, you name it, to, again, the production of this video.
Talked about his rehabilitation and his, not only his rehabilitation, but the fact that he was now drug-free, had gone through forced rehab.
Right.
In the jail for 14 months, but used that as also an example of mitigation, that he would be coming out sober as opposed to drugged up.
Right. And mind you, I would never encourage incarceration as a form of rehabilitation, because all know that, you know, jails are not designed to deal with severe and persistent mental illness, nor severe drug addiction. But obviously, and quite frankly, if we can be real, some prisons and some jails, you can get more and better drugs there than you can on the streets. So it may not necessarily be true that Mr. Combs is completely drug-free, depending upon what the availability of some drugs may be while incarcerated, because there is, you know, this is just a well-known fact that drugs flow freely in incarceration environments, including
jail. Maybe
he's
been tested, though.
Maybe, or maybe not, or maybe these are, you know, protestations on his part. So, the other thing is, I think he even had a letter from one of the another person that was also incarcerated that talked about how much of a mentor he had been. But as we talk about all these as mitigating and or lessening factors, the judge and also the prosecution is going to speak to what they call the aggravating factors. The fact that, you know, at least very early on, there was efforts to intimidate witnesses or to get witnesses to not participate. Ironically enough, one of the prosecution's witnesses who they could not find and locate during the presentation of their case in chief miraculously appeared for sentencing on behalf of Mr. Combs. And I'm I'm sure that was to the prosecution's dismay, as they would have liked to have been able to find or have access to this witness, because I think they were identified as like Jane Doe number three or something. But the court really did exactly what you said, which is it balanced these two competing interests, because they were on two very different extremes. One of which saying, hey, cut him loose today, let him go. He served enough time. He's clean, he's sober, and he's learned his lesson. While the other says, wait a minute, you know what? He hasn't served nearly the amount of time he deserves to serve, given everything that we know. And even the prosecution brought in facts, evidence, and even statements related to charges he wasn't convicted of, but to kind of show the pattern of potential aggression, abuse, you know, flouting court orders, you name it. And I think the judge did a very masterful job of just balancing those two. And I'd actually invite your input on something like this, because I really think that somewhere, you know, in the 5 to 7 year range would have been sufficient to respond even to the two charges. And I would have run them concurrent. I would not have run them consecutive. And I think where the judge landed at 50 months was just right around that sweet spot there.
Yeah, it was, we used to use the old biblical analogy of the wisdom of Solomon slicing the baby in half, right? But, you know, that aside, it's, you try to find that place in the middle. You know, both sides are coming in with the extreme, and the judge is not given to the extreme necessarily, unless there's horrendous aggravating circumstances, crimes of violence and that type of thing. So I agree with you. I think the judge hit the sweet spot here. And I don't think that anybody's going to really look askance at his sentence. One thing I did want to bring up, and then
we need
to move on.
There's always going to be an appeal.
There'll be an appeal, but I don't think it'll get anywhere, at least not on the sentencing portion of this. If both are asking for pardons, both Maxwell and Combs are asking for pardons, does the president have to do the same thing, or can he do one, give one to one and not the other? How does that work your mind strategically?
Do we not know how? And again, I'd love to say that there is a normality to this, right? And that there's a process that's followed. And there is, you know, perhaps precedent, which, you know, apparently Justice Thomas thinks is just a suggestion now. But
yeah,
that's a conversation for another day. But I would love to say that, hey, we can rely on there being a process for pardon. After all, DOJ has a pardon attorney, and there's a whole division that kind of reviews these. But I would, you know, I think I've reached the point where I am becoming so disappointed in at least what I'm seeing as it's unfolding. And I'm not going to suggest that there isn't some ability or way for DOJ and others to redeem themselves. But right now, it is, I think it's entirely possible for the pardon to go to either the highest bidder or to the person that, you know, perhaps has the most dirt and is willing to keep the, you know, keep the bodies buried. And yeah, that to me, I think is unfortunate. Now, we all know that, you know, Sean Combs is, or at least he was, you know, a millionaire many times over, maybe even a billionaire. And so I also think that, you know, this may be one of those circumstances where, you know, yes, the nod can go to the highest bidder. And I'd hate to think that that is even possible, because that means people who are at the lowest rungs of society, who don't have access to resources and may in fact be good candidates for pardons or commutations or having their cases revisited. If that's how we treat it, imagine how we, if we treated every appeal like that, then that meant that only, you know, only the rich or only the well-connected or only those right, with resources would ever get it. And that's
connections with power.
Yeah. And that's exactly what we've eschewed in a justice system that says justice is for all without regard to your, without regard to how much, how many zeros you have in your bank account, which I can tell you, I probably know more people with more 0.00 bank accounts than people that have, you know, a common number followed by zeros in their bank account. But that means that's exactly why we need to reinfuse faith in this whole system of justice, because it just won't work if we foster a system that says, well, you know what, maybe Ghislaine Maxwell, who, by the way, was a socialite, I believe her dad was extraordinarily wealthy.
Yeah,
and she may not have money, but if what she may hold by way of information, that ace up her attorney's sleeve, if what she may hold by way of information that the prosecution ought to already know about and is perhaps feigning that they know nothing about, if that is valuable, that could probably be and potentially be more valuable than any amount of money than Mr. Combs could have. Or both right, of them could end up with pardons just for different reasons. One person just has some information that is extremely valuable, and the other person just happens to have a lot of money, and well, that is valuable. Both of which is unfair, and it stinks.
We'll keep you updated, audience, because, you know, things move quickly in the law these days. And so we'll try to keep you up to date if we hear any more. But let's move on to the topic of the day, which is really a feud going on in the District of Columbia in Washington, D.C. Over the past month, the federal prosecutors have brought all kinds of charges to grand juries as a result of the militarized police action, and that's my term, police action in the District of Columbia by the National Guard, as well as the all of the federal agencies. But the key is here that the federal prosecutors have had nearly a dozen cases rejected by grand juries for indictments against people caught up in this federal crackdown. So remember, we talked about grand juries. Grand juries are a screening device where prosecutors take their case secretly, no defense, no cross-examination. Prosecutions take their case to a group of citizens, and all the group of citizens have to find is there probable cause that a crime was committed and that the defendant committed the crime? That's it. We've joked, Judge Gale and
very
I.
Very low threshold.
Yeah. We've talked about you could indict a ham sandwich. You know, it's the lowest standard of proof necessary in the law. However, nearly a dozen cases were rejected by grand juries, thinking that people overcharged. There wasn't the case there. Remember, if some of you may recall, the guy who threw a sub sandwich, a submarine sandwich or a hoagie sandwich, threw it at one of the officers and was charged with felonious assault with a deadly weapon. You know, so that wasn't, he didn't get indicted for that. That was one of the 12 cases where the grand jury rejected the indictment. But what's happened here recently, just in the last week or so, when the DOJ, the Department of Justice attorneys, when they failed to get an indictment at a federal grand jury on federal charges, they've taken it to what would be equivalent of a state grand jury, and it's just a different court in D.C. since it's all federal. But they take it to a different court and take the same case to a different court with a different grand jury. And they did this until one of the magistrate judges, a guy by the name of Zia Farugi, and his last name spelled F-A-R-U-Q-U-I. I've listened to a bunch of things on YouTube, how to pronounce it. I believe it's Farugi is his name. But he said, enough. We're not doing this. This is inappropriate. This is unseemly and probably unlawful. So he didn't refuse the indictment, but he said, I want this briefed by both sides. I want it briefed by the prosecution, and I want it briefed by the defense on whether or not this is appropriate. And once he did that, all hell broke loose. Am I right?
Absolutely. And you summarized it, as you always do, it just amazingly well. And I was shocked just upon learning that this is what federal prosecutors, or any prosecutors for that matter, would engage in. You know, having been a former prosecutor, you know, you don't always get to decide everything, right? Prosecutors have an enormous amount of power and responsibility. Consider the fact, judges, you know, prosecutors already have essentially the upper hand when it comes to indicting, to charging, arresting, and indicting cases. And why do I say that? Because this is all state action. You know, defense attorneys aren't out here arresting their own clients. They are waiting for the state to act to place someone under arrest before they spring into action. They aren't the ones deciding on the charges. Very infrequently does a defense attorney get consulted or even informed about the charges their client faces before they're formalized. When it comes to presenting cases to a grand jury, the only people that are in the room for that presentation, aside from the grand jurors themselves, is the prosecutor and the prosecutor's witness. That means the defense is not there. The defendant
There's no challenge.
And a court reporter. I apologize. The other individual there is a court reporter, because grand jury proceedings are recorded, but they are sealed, and they're only unsealed under the most extreme circumstances. So that means prosecutors have this opportunity. Over the lifespan of a grand jury being seated, they can rapport build with these grand jurors. They've presented cases to them more likely than not many times over. They bring in, they choose which officers actually present the case to the grand jury, which tells me if you have a grand jury that at some point decides after you have all of these elements kind of stacked in your favor and they still decide to deny or decline your request to indict, is because you don't have anybody from the defense giving their side or their version. Very rarely does someone else, like a victim, even come to testify at the grand jury. Then that means if the grand jury is not indicting, and you've still taken it to the grand jury, by the way, because there's an opportunity to say, we're not even taking this to the grand jury because the case itself is not that strong. It's not firm. And if you still nonetheless decide to do that, and that grand jury decides or declines to indict, that is a telltale sign, in my view, that you have a case that has more holes in it than Swiss cheese. And you should probably consider not moving forward, because the idea, as you said, Judge, should not just be, even though the standard at that stage is probable cause, was a crime committed? Is this likely the person that's committed the crime? Those are the basic questions that are asked at the grand jury stage. However, I would encourage prosecutors to be thinking about the higher standard of beyond a reasonable doubt, even at the time that they're indicting, because you can clear the lowest bar. That's the ham sandwich, right? You can indict the ham sandwich just to get the probable cause standard satisfied. But if you don't have a strong enough case where you believe you can win a conviction when the standard is beyond a reasonable doubt, then maybe you should be reconsidering whether you indict the case at all. But then to go the extra step to have the grand jury, the federal grand jury, say, no thanks, we're not indicting it. I was so shocked. It's not illegal. I don't know. I don't believe that it's necessarily illegal. I believe it's absolutely abnormal. And I think it's just as abnormal to basically put your case in a shopping cart and shop it to a grand jury as you would shop it to a judge that you believe is favorable to you. I think both of those things are just particularly stunning. And it does not comport with the behavior of the United States Department of Justice as we've understood it heretofore. We've not seen this happen before.
We'll get to that in a second, but I wanted to share a quote from Magistrate Faruqi. He said, this is his quote, "Typically, when a grand jury refuses to return indictments in a case, either the government takes the message as a warning to go no further, or hopefully, in only the rarest of cases, presents the indictment again to another federal grand jury. To this judge's knowledge, what has never happened before is doing an end run around the federal grand jury completely." Now, he says that, and then he went on, Judge, he went on to talk about his days as a former prosecutor and his observations that this Justice Department is overcharging and trampling on defendants' rights. But he said that the Trump lawyers are upending, and I want your take on this, the traditional bonds of trust, known as, quote, presumption of regularity given to government attorneys. Now, you were a government attorney, albeit a state government attorney, but the same difference. This presumption of regularity and trust given to government attorneys, Judge Faruqi said it's being turned on its head by the Department of Justice.
And absolutely. And think about the fact that I think what the alarm he's trying to sound is for the benefit, actually, of the prosecutors to say, wait a minute, you guys walk in the door with this presumption that you are here to safeguard everybody's rights. We naturally assume and presume that you wear the white hats, that you are here to ensure that all rights are protected, that you don't have a win at all cost attitude, and that you're not willing to just do anything just for the sake of scoring on the scoreboard.
Trample on anyone's rights.
Exactly. And by trampling rights in order to do that. And I think what he was trying to convey to the prosecution is the enormity of their responsibility, not just in the instant case, but in every case, into this entire system of justice. And that by doing what they did, which is essentially saying, well, if we can't win it here, we'll win it someplace else, but we'll get it. And that goes back to that kind of, you know, ham sandwich, sub sandwich, whatever kind of sandwich, peanut butter and jelly sandwich, indictment model that he's suggesting is what is squandering that trust that has been long built between society and communities and its own government, and particularly the Department of Justice, upon whom lots of people rely for them to be, again, the white hat wearers, right? For the ones to, you know, fight crime, keep communities safe, ensure that they are prosecuting only the right cases and not winning at all costs and not making examples of people and not just trying to run up the score because they have the power and the resources to do so. And that this was really for a judge who was a former federal prosecutor, and I feel kind of similarly as
a
judge.
It was a step too far, wasn't it?
It is really heartbreaking because it can take a lifetime to build up this trust between communities and citizens and their government, but it only takes one act to tear it down. And now when you have the demonstration potentially of several acts or several perceived acts, then it really does. You can erode trust a lot faster than you can build it. And this is a meaningful act that they're doing that has repercussions and ripples, meaning you're not doing something that just doesn't matter to anybody. What you're doing is you're actually, maybe you don't realize it, you're engaging in behavior that is literally chipping away. It is like taking a chisel to the foundational trust that has been built and reinforced and affirmed over and over again between the people and their government. And it is almost like saying, to hell with it. We'll do whatever we can or need to do in order to get our way. And that is heartbreaking, not just to the justice system, but it also deepens that mistrust between some communities and some people in society that's already raising an eyebrow at what's happening. They trust it even less. And this becomes another example of it.
Judge Faruqi said that. He said in another quote, "This only deepens the growing mistrust." Mm-hmm. Of actions of the prosecution. You know, that is a sentiment that was once unthinkable, but the irregular is now the regular, he said.
And you know, I think he was given, lies the squandering. That is
he was given a warning, but mm-hmm. you know, they didn't heed it.
And it wasn't, I don't even take it as chiding as much as it is, hey, you already walk in with deference. You walk in with inherent respect. When you come into the room,
you walk in as the United States of America.
Yes,
walk in as the state of Ohio or the Commonwealth of Virginia or whatever the case may be. You have the power of the government behind you.
And remember, taxpayers don't get to choose whether or not to fund you. Our tax dollars are going to support the Department of Justice, whether we like it or not, whether we trust it or not. What is unfortunate, and I think what he was trying to express is, insofar as you have been vested with this trust and this authority, to take those two things and to essentially just kind of throw them to the wind and whisk them away, and to now make what is so unnatural, so it's something that is so abnormal, and now feed the people the line that this is now what's normal, this should be normalized, is something that will not do anything for restoration of trust. Now they will trust you even less because they see you as, again, forum shopping in a sense. And this isn't shopping to the favorite judge. Now it's just trying to clear the lowest bar. You mean to tell me you have to shop your case just to get the lowest bar met? That should tell you something.
Well, I want to move on to the next stage because the story is not complete yet. And that is, first of all, Jeanine Pirro, the U.S. attorney, former Fox News commentator.
And former judge.
Former judge for a minute, said she that this judge was an activist judge and the judge should focus more on his cases than trying to chide prosecutors.
But this is his case.
So there was an emergency hearing end of last week as a result of this, and the briefs were submitted. And instead of Judge Faruqi sitting on the hearing, which, you know, he now sort of is a party to all of this, the Chief U.S. District Judge of the D.C. District, James Boasberg, and we've talked about him before.
Oh, we know him.
Esteemed judge, sat on the case and admonished Pirro's staff to remain civil in court proceedings, expressing concern about an escalating dispute between the prosecutors and the court. He said it would be in everybody's best interest to turn the temperature down. But this is what I wanted to get to. Pirro's office, a guy by the name of Jonathan R. Hornock, H-O-R-N-O-K, assistant U.S. attorney, head of the criminal division, filed an 18-page brief to the court, just chiding Judge Faruqi up one side and down the other. He called him, he said he was, I want to get the exact quote, accused Faruqi of bloviating from the bench and ignoring the law. Now, this is an attorney saying this of a judge. The judge is bloviating behind the bench and ignoring the law. I thought I knew what bloviating meant, but I went and looked it up, Judge Gale, and it means talk at length, especially in an inflated or empty way.
Ooh-wee.
So he said the judge was bloviating, talking at length, especially in an inflated and empty way. Judge Boasberg said that in all his days, he'd had plenty of cases both as a prosecutor and a judge, and he would never have filed a pleading accusing a judge of bloviating. So now we're not only getting to the DOJ not following normal procedures and the presumption of regularity, but now they're attacking the judiciary at the same time.
Yes. And what I think is most striking, at least in this regard, because of course there's the argument of, well, the state has a right to aggressively prosecute its cases. And there's one thing to aggressively prosecute your case. There's something quite different, however, to completely disregard the rules of ethical and professional responsibility and how prosecutors should deal with the court, should show deference to the court and respect. And listen, I agree with Judge Boasberg. I've had plenty of times when you know, I did not. And when I was a prosecutor, I didn't particularly care for a ruling. I mean, there were times when I think I almost walked right up to the contempt line, but I wasn't going to step on it or cross over it. But, you know, and that comes with, you know, really having faith in your case. But what I think he's speaking to is it actually tracks with what we are seeing as kind of this new pandemic of behavior out of the Department of Justice, where, you know, it's nothing. There is a time when I would really be careful about choosing my words and describing my discontent with the court's ruling or explaining. And I probably certainly would not have done it in an 18-page brief and certainly not even at a press conference. But there are so many instances now where the disrespect and disregard, and I think one of the things that's pretty shocking is actually, you know, Attorney Pirro's disrespect and disregard for the bench. Even when she said, you know, the judge should, you know, not be an activist judge and just focus on
tend to your cases,
tend
judge.
To your cases, and this is one of his cases. So she's actually doing the very thing you're suggesting the judge should do. But I have to think about, well, gosh, when you were on the bench, would you have ever tolerated an attorney ever?
No.
Talking to you like that or speaking to you, because one thing the court has to do is it has to jealously guard the reputation of the judicial process, lest everyone disrespect it and the court's orders along with it.
Judge Gale, I want to make this clear because you're making a great point. But, you know, if somebody disrespected me, it wasn't the fact that they were disrespecting me. They were disrespecting the office of a judge.
Exactly.
And the judiciary. You know,
exactly.
My personality and my personal affronts aside, they were attacking the court. They
were attacking the rule of law. What's forming the seat? I just care that it is the court. And the court, yes, in that moment may be represented by this particular judge. But if that judge isn't there and a different one is there, either the next term, next year, you know, next day, whatever, it is still the court that must be respected. It is the rule of law that is represented in that room and that is upheld and pronounced through that court that must be respected and upheld. And it is so disappointing that, again, you have U.S. Attorney Pirro, who sat as a judge and so understands the amount of respect and deference that is expected in these types of proceedings, and to nonetheless, you know, engage it personally is, again, it's like an affront. It's almost as if the rules of professional conduct have been abandoned and that there is no reason to even be governed by them. And I just have to sit and wonder, well, you know, what do these attorneys expect when kind of this window in time has passed, right? So when it's all said and done, is there the expectation that they'll still be celebrated as blowhards or tough prosecutors or, you know, really, really firm? Or do they really think and believe that the same rules that govern all of us will govern them and that history will judge them pretty harshly
for the
manner that they've treated the profession and how they've treated the court?
I think that we can look at what they say now as indication of how they'll respond to that. This Hornock, he wrote in that court brief, the 18-page brief, that Judge Faruqi violated judicial conduct rules by making disparaging comments about prosecutors in the presence of local grand jury foreperson and argued that the judge may have harmed the government's chances of getting indictments in other cases. Now, I'll come back to that. That's saying, okay, we're victims. We're not the aggressors. We're not the people who are tearing down the protocols of the court and not following the codes of conduct. We're the victims because the judge spoke out, which is just, to me, absurd. But it goes on, and this is the best part. This is a quote. Magistrate Faruqi's actions are legally unsupported, are inflammatory, have already interfered with and tainted the community's grand juries, and show a clear bias against the government that is not based in rational or objective facts. All right, Hornock added, quote, Judge Faruqi's bloviate first and consider the law later approach is just the latest example of his demonstrated prejudice against the U.S. attorney and the Trump administration. That says it all right there. All of a sudden, the attacker has become the victim.
Yeah, which it just seems, and it also seems to suggest the motive of the judge, right? Is that, you know, the judge is just prejudiced against the U.S. Attorney's Office, from which he hails, by the way, and that his prejudice also extends to the administration, which I don't know that that's the case. I think that calling the prosecutors to account for their behavior is absolutely appropriate.
And process and procedure.
And that's exactly what a judge should do. And they should also do that, because the other argument would be, well, the judge denied acceptance of the indictment and never made a record, so we don't even know why. Or, you know, you can't have it both ways. This could also be, you know, some effort to force recusal of Judge Faruqi from the case, although it's unclear as to whether or not he would handle it from beginning to end.
I don't think he would, probably.
But that's the other thing, is if the strategy is that every time we're met with disapproval by the bench, then we just put up the fiercest fight, we become the victim, we blame the court, and then we'll ultimately get to the jurist that we want. That is maniacal, but also could be a strategy as well. It's an unfortunate strategy because, again, I think it kind of plays into and leads to that idea of having less and less faith in the system and the process, when in fact you want people to have faith in the system and the process without regard to who the judge is, right? You want them to have faith that, hey, this is going to work. They're going to bring, if they're bringing to bear the United States Department of Justice that has all of these assets and resources, then they can build a winning case, and it doesn't have to be based upon who the judge is. The case and the facts themselves will win the day. It is, you know, it's that leaning into that idea of res ipsa loquitur, the thing will speak for itself without regard to who the judge is. The thing will speak for itself. We've got the better case, and we're going to put on the better evidence, and the conviction is going to come because this is what we all have lined up. In fact, you know, I think I may have said in a prior episode, you know, there's a time when we say, you know, when the feds come knocking, it ain't never good news. And the reason is because, you know, the full weight of that office has the ability to investigate all kinds of things. Matter of fact, I'll even tell you, you know, from my own experience, I had a, you know, an extremely maniacal racist mayor in the city that I sat in. And just as I left the bench, I genuinely believe that she and others were behind contacting the United States Department of Justice to ask them to investigate me for reasons I still am not clear of. And it is the idea of having that happen that can really unsteady someone, because you can be led to believe that, oh my gosh, again, here comes the ham sandwich. They can indict a ham sandwich.
Sure.
And in my experience, in my instance, nothing ever came of it because I knew there was nothing there. But it doesn't, if I were just the average regular Joe Schmo that did not have kind of faith in my own activities and the fact that the evidence just didn't exist, you could really become undone by this kind of behavior. And again, who's to say that, heck, if they weren't happy with the federal grand jury saying, nope, there's nothing there, that you don't have prosecutors that'll say, well, we'll find, you know, some people somewhere that'll say that, yes, there he is, in order to just get the indictment. That's really scary, and it makes you not trust the system at all. And so I'm happy that in this instance, the whoever the racist buttholes were that inspired this investigation, I hope that they know, and I hope they listen to Next Witness, Please, to be reminded that nothing came of it. But that is an abuse, if you will, in my view. That's an abuse of power. It's an abuse of the power that prosecutors are given and are expected to use judiciously and fairly in order to really achieve the ends of justice. And becoming the victim because you don't like the fact that the judge has chided you over your antics is not how you would reinfuse that trust.
Well, there, Judge Boasberg sort of left it at this. He said that lawyers have an ethical and professional responsibility to be civil to one another and to the court. Now, this is where this is falling down. This is not occurring with the Trump administration. This is not occurring with this Justice Department. We're having judges all over the country being threatened, being challenged.
That is true.
Not based on their judicial opinion, but the fact that they made a ruling against this administration.
Or that they disagree.
And there are judges appointed by Ronald Reagan, some even appointed by President Trump. You know, judges from all walks of life have, and all political persuasions, have ruled against this administration, especially at the district court and the appellate levels. But now, because that we can't believe in the rule of law and the process, we go on personal attacks like bloviating and personal other heinous personal attacks and actually threatening judges. State judge just this past weekend had her house blown up.
Wow.
Because of a case. Because we now have this atmosphere where it is not only okay, it's encouraged to threaten the judiciary. That's
right. Talk
where we
about
are.
Needing to turn the temperature down. I mean, you know, you're. Now, when you begin to threaten the lives of members of the judiciary, you just really have to wonder and worry, you know, what kind of America are we becoming? We cannot also agree and accept as normal what just is not. This is abnormal. This is not acceptable. Now, here's what I am not saying. I am not suggesting that there's no one who has a right to disagree with the ruling of a judge.
No, but there are processes for that.
It is. It's okay to not like it. I bet you could just as much as I could. We could identify many, many times when our rulings were not to the liking of one party or another. And there is a way to disagree respectfully, especially when judges are themselves trying to, you know, operate kind of at that higher end of emotional intelligence. If you're not having judges that are yelling and calling names and, you know, just completely undressing parties and attorneys in open court and disrespecting them, then I think that there has to be some reciprocal respect from all sides of the room that says, hey, listen, you know what? I don't like what the court did. I don't agree with what the court did. I am not in favor of what the court did. There is a process in place called an appeals process that allows for me to air those disagreements and to some minor degree, those frustrations with the process. But what I am not allowed to do, right? The line I cannot cross is the one that says, you know what? I don't like that you did your job in a way that did not favor me. And because of that, I'm going to risk your life. or I'm going to risk the life of your loved ones, or I'm going to risk your safety, or I am going to denigrate you publicly. I'm going to use the largest bully pulpit available to just completely disregard you as an authority, because the only time I will recognize your authority and your ability and your right to even issue rulings is when it's favorable to me. Now, that is kind of the height of sore loserism, but it takes it to a whole nother level that is exceptionally dangerous. And we've seen the results of that. We've seen how that manifests. And we have to be able to and willing to push back and say it's just not acceptable for this three-legged stool, this thing we call democracy, where we have the executive, legislative, and judicial branches sharing this co-equal power in government and trying its best, I think. And I think the judiciary, quite frankly, is probably trying harder than anybody at this point to kind of keep this thing of a knitted democratic blanket together, to keep it from fraying to the point of being unrecognizable, that you cannot then just take a match and light the whole blanket on fire because you don't like the rulings of the third leg of the stool. That is just, these are all kinds of mixed metaphors. So just follow me on this. But at the end of the day, it's mind blowing that in any way normalize this and say that this is acceptable. It is not. I if I were probably that judge, it would be everything to keep from holding people in contempt. I would probably personally be filing disciplinary actions with the boards of professional responsibility. It's uncalled for. It's disrespectful. And yes, you can disagree with the judge, but I'm not certain that we should still permit individuals to retain law licenses who so willingly, so forcefully, so obviously disregard the court. I just, mind you, many of them are going to look to be elevated to the bench themselves. So what happens when you get there and we've now normalized to the point where all you're doing is signing up to be disrespected in your black robe?
Well, let me end on this. I think the presumption of regularity that Judge Faruqi talked about is gone. And I think the rule of law in this country is teetering on the brink. We have dedicated judges at both the state and federal level that are trying to keep our system of justice upright and going forward. But it's being torn down at every possible level. And that is a danger to democracy and a danger to us all. With that, Judge, how do people get us?
Well, after you've seen your therapist and you've listened to Next Witness, Please, we invite you to catch us on every major platform where you find your favorite podcasts. That includes even National Public Radio, continues to be a strong and ardent supporter of ours. You can also catch us on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, or again, anywhere you catch your favorite podcast. We are so honored to continue to bring you Next Witness, Please, and to educate you about processes and ongoing cases, because we genuinely continue to believe that you don't trust what you don't understand. And our goal is to increase your understanding in the hopes that by extension, you will trust us more.
We want you to understand, and we try desperately to break it down into understandable terms for you each and every episode. So if you have any questions or comments about our podcast, you can always email them to me. You can do that at my email address, which is Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, at ohio.edu.
Again, why don't you say it one more time, Tom?
Hodson at ohio.edu. And if you have topics that you would like for us to cover in the future, please shoot me an email and we'll add your topic to our list. Next Witness, Please is produced through the facilities of WOUB Public Media at Ohio University. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. Judge Gail and I will be back real soon to give you more insights into the law and current events with the law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.